KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
To force other countries to come hat in hand, pleading for a deal, Beijing's just not willing to play that game.
The White House backed off a bit more on tariffs today, but China is holding firm. We will hear why from Beijing for Saturday, April 12th. It's All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow. Had the latest on new nuclear talks between Iran and the U.S. and the latest on the Trump White House's attacks on law firms. We'll also hear how health departments across the country are coping with the prospect of big cuts in federal funding.
Someone that doesn't have insurance or doesn't have access to health care, they're going to be the ones that suffer from the cuts.
And as it hits 100, we'll talk to two high school teachers on how they tackle the Great Gatsby in the classroom.
We can all layer our identities on top of Gatsby and find a way for us to exist within one of America's greatest novels.
That and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Apple, NVIDIA, and other tech companies landed major relief in President Trump exempting smartphones and other electronics from new tariffs. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the tech industry had been bracing itself for a major shock.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection published tariff exclusions late Friday that include smartphones, laptops, memory chips, and machines that create semiconductors. Fear of a sudden spike in the price of iPhones sent some customers rushing to buy new devices. And Apple chartered a cargo plane from India to fly 600 tons of iPhones out to avoid the new levies. But Apple and NVIDIA, two of the most valuable companies in the world, have for now won a reprieve. The Trump administration has pushed tech companies to manufacture more electronics in the U.S., but executives say the cost of labor, advanced supply chains abroad, along with hyper-specialized workers, would make moving production to the U.S. in some cases nearly impossible. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
EU economic ministers have wrapped up a two-day meeting in Poland focused on how to mobilize more money for defense at a time of economic uncertainty. Terry Schultz reports U.S. tariffs on the EU are adding to the bloc's difficulties.
EU economic and finance ministers met in Warsaw to discuss new ways the bloc is offering to help the 27 member states invest more in their own security. These include suspending the penalties governments incur for going into too much debt and offering loans backed by the EU itself as long as the money is spent on defense. EU Economy Commissioner Valdis Dombrovskis says such investment will pay off in other ways too.
Beyond enhancing Europe's security, we expect additional defense spending to also boost competitiveness and economic growth, drive innovation, and create jobs.
Dombrovskis says the 25% tariffs on EU steel and aluminum exports that President Trump has left in place will hurt the U.S. more than the EU. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
A federal judge has declined to block the Trump administration from immigration enforcement actions at houses of worship. NPR's Jason DeRose reports more than two dozen religious organizations had asked for a preliminary injunction.
For years, DHS operated under a letter of guidance that said immigration officers should avoid enforcement actions at certain sensitive locations, including hospitals, schools, and houses of worship. The Trump administration rescinded that guidance, and a number of congregations took the administration to court, saying the fear of immigration raids was harming their ability to worship. But Judge Dabney Friedrich of the D.C. District Court found that there are few signs the plaintiffs are being harmed, and so denied a preliminary injunction. She wrote that the congregations would have to show stronger evidence that immigration officers were targeting their specific houses of worship. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. The death toll from the roof collapse at a nightclub in the Dominican Republic this week has risen to at least 225 after four people who were hospitalized after being rescued from the rubble died overnight. More than 200 people were injured. The roof collapsed during a merengue concert. New York City Mayor Eric Adams visits the country tomorrow to stand in solidarity with the Dominican community. New York has the largest Dominican population outside of the Dominican Republic. NBA star LeBron James is now the first professional male athlete to be depicted by a Ken doll. NPR's Mondelez Del Barco reports he's the newest toy in the Barbie line.
Mattel says LeBron James is a role model, and his doll will be the toy line's new Kenbassador. The doll is an inch taller than other Ken dolls. It wears shades, headphones, Nike sneakers, a fanny pack, and his signature gold watch and wristband. His blue and white jacket has his initials and his basketball jersey number 23. Scrolled on the back of his outfit is James's catchphrase, "Just a kid from Akron."
Oh, he dope.
James was all smiles when handed his doll, a moment captured on video for the Associated Press.
Just a kid from Akron, got his Beats headphones. This is so dang old cool.
The LeBron James Ken doll costs $75 and goes on sale Monday. He joins Mattel's 9 female athlete Barbie dolls introduced last year, including one of tennis star Venus Williams. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Subaru. In partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Over the past 10 days, President Trump introduced tariffs on imports from nearly every country on the planet, then watched markets enter a tailspin, and then, earlier this week, he abruptly lowered most of those tariffs, at least for the next 3 months. But not tariffs on products made in China. In fact, they have been jacked way up. The minimum tariff on Chinese imports is now 145%. That is on top of pre-existing tariffs from the first Trump administration and the Biden administration, which already affected the majority of Chinese imports. Though, last night, the Trump administration made yet another switch and carved out an exemption for smartphones, computers, and some other devices. Those electronics aside, though, China is not having it. The country has matched each U.S. increase with its own, raising global fears of what happens next if the world's two biggest markets keep putting up more walls between each other. Joined now by NPR's John Ruich, who has been watching all of this unfold from his perch in Beijing. Hey, John.
Hey, Scott.
Let me start with this. What is the mood in China, the other ground zero of this trade war?
The other one, yeah. It feels a little different than it did when the first trade war during the first Trump administration broke out, when there was much more panic is probably the wrong word, but sky is falling type of vibe. I've been keeping an eye on two areas here where the reaction is unfolding. One is the government and the other is from the export sector. The government's been interesting to watch because they've really been projecting defiance. I want to play a clip from a video that the Chinese embassy in Washington and other foreign ministry officials have been sharing. This is audio from 1953. So that's the voice of Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao. So the Korean War was raging in 53. And in that clip, Mao says it's not China that decides how long this war will go on. It's the U.S. president, whoever that may be. But no matter how long it goes on, China will never yield and it will emerge victorious. And that's really the vibe here. They're projecting the same type of attitude. The Foreign Ministry and Commerce Ministry have been calling the U.S. a bully, saying the U.S. has been blackmailing everybody around the world. And China has literally said that it's standing up for free trade and standing up for the rest of the world.
I mean, I think that video really underscores just how much the Chinese government is digging in here. And as I mentioned earlier, they have been upping the ante on their end, matching Trump's tariffs, right?
Yeah, they have. It's a new approach for China. In the first trade war, they imposed some tariffs on the U.S., but it wasn't matching. It wasn't the same magnitude. And they always did retaliate, but going toe-to-toe is something new. Here's Gabriel Wildow, an analyst who follows China's political economy at the consultancy Teneo.
I think Chinese leaders, like a lot of leaders around the world, have come to the conclusion that the real objective behind Trump's tariffs is to assert dominance and to force other countries to come hat in hand, pleading for a deal. And Beijing's just not willing to play that game.
National pride is at stake. They're talking about free trade ideals.
and they don't want to set a precedent. It's worth pointing out that China's being careful not to escalate here, right, beyond the rhetoric. Mm-hmm. The government here is saying that they don't want a trade war, that trade wars and tariff wars are lose-lose, but that they will fight if they have to. And all their steps have been reactions. That's also worth noting. They're not going on the offensive. After they raised tariffs on Friday, they actually said they're not going to be raising tariffs anymore if Trump continues to raise tariffs, because there's no point in it. But they will protect China's interests and rights. That may take the whole trade war into a different direction.
Huh.
There will be economic fallout, but China does feel like it's willing to take it. Here's Wildow again.
They would rather absorb some economic pain now as a way to draw a line and signal that they're not going to be bullied, rather than placate Trump now in the expectation that he would only come back later with new demands.
Interesting. Okay, so that's the government. What about the export sector, though? Businesses that sell abroad, how are they reacting to this?
Sure. Our producer, Alwen Cao, found a freight forwarder in the city of Yiwu, which is in Zhejiang province. It's famous as an export hub. There's a massive wholesale market there. Jiang Kun is the guy's name. He says basically lighter tariffs, you know, raising the tariffs at lower increments, like the initial 10% and then 10% again earlier this year, that was manageable. That was shared among exporters, shippers, customers. Mm-hmm. These tariffs are just a different thing altogether. It's too fast and too high. He says he has customers who are hitting pause on shipments to the U.S. And the shipping takes time, right? It takes a few weeks. Nobody can say what policy is going to look like tomorrow, let alone 3 weeks from now when the products land in America. So some businesses are already looking for other markets, potentially abandoning the U.S. market altogether, he says. And they're doing that because they have to keep their factories running and keep workers paid.
I mean, when you say that, let's just play that out to its logical conclusion. So many goods come from China that are sold in the U.S. Could we have a situation where these goods stop flowing altogether to the United States?
Well, that's what Jiang Kun thinks is happening now, and others also think it amounts to basically trade decoupling. I mean, to get goods into the U.S., someone has to pay the tariff, right? And analysts say this tariff is way bigger right now, obviously, than the average profit margin on any Chinese import. There are workarounds, of course. Transshipment is one of them. That's where a product is basically made here in China. It touches another country. Maybe it's assembled there, then ships to the U.S. It might have a made in Thailand or a made in Vietnam tag on it. Chinese companies may continue that trend of doing that. They may continue also to build capacity in these other countries. It kind of depends on what happens with Trump's tariff deals with those countries. Jiang Kun says the shipping disruption is real, though. It's going to have a whip-like effect eventually if these tariffs are lower. There's going to be overstocked warehouses, misplaced shipments. Remember all the chaos in shipping during the pandemic.
All of these long-term decisions that need to be made as the policies change day by day. I mean, that's the government, that's the companies. Let's talk about the other big factor here, Chinese workers. What does this do for them?
Workers in China is kind of a complex issue. Yes, you know, companies that go out of business because of this, that may happen, or move their production elsewhere, shut down in China, that may happen. That's bad for the workers here in China. At the same time, though, there are sectors of industry in China that have worker shortages now, that actually have a hard time hiring people. And Chinese industry is becoming increasingly automated. So how it all shakes out, we don't know.
Yeah. Big picture, what should we understand from your perspective? You're somebody who's covered China for a long time now at this point. What should we understand about Beijing's ability to maintain a steadfast approach compared to the United States, where we have seen this go backwards and forwards based on the markets?
Yeah, from Beijing's perspective, I do think there's a little bit of an our political system versus your political system thing going on here. And Xi Jinping is very confident that the Chinese system can weather this storm. It's prepared for the economic downtick from this trade war. And right now, you know, the decision making that's happening here, it's political. It's not in China's economic interest to have a trade war. It's not in China's economic interest to have 125% tariffs on the U.S. It's a political interest.
That is NPR's John Ruich in Beijing. John, always good to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Ecuador is famous for its beaches and its capital city, Quito, high in the foothills of the Andes. But in the past few years, Ecuador has been dragged into a brutal international drug war, resulting in one of the highest homicide rates in Latin America. That has helped make tomorrow's elections one of the country's most important in years. NPR's Carrie Kahn joins us from Ecuador. Hey, Carrie.
Hi.
So let's start with this. Where are you, and what is the mood like there?
I'm in Guayaquil. It's the biggest city in Ecuador. It's also its economic center here. Unfortunately, this port city and surrounding towns have become the most dangerous and deadly. As for the mood, I'd say people are just guarded and anxious for this election to come to an end. They're exhausted from the violence that's engulfed the country in recent years. And actually, in recent months, January and February of this year have been the most violent ever recorded, with a homicide every hour being reported.
Wow. Can you just contextualize that for us a little more? Why has this violence erupted so quickly?
First, it's been several years of gang violence here, with the last few increasingly brutal as gangs splinter and fight for territory. Ecuador, in the geography, is sandwiched between Colombia and Peru. Those are the biggest cocaine producers in the world. And Ecuador brings a lot of other advantages besides geography. It's a dollar economy. Money laundering is easier here. Its visa laws had always been lax, and that allowed a lot of foreigners to easily come in, and corruption is widespread. Mm-hmm. It has extensive ports and a long Pacific coastline, lending great access to routes to the U.S. and also to Europe, which has seen a surge in cocaine use. Currently, there are Mexican, Colombian, and even Albanian cartels operating here. And of course, together with Ecuador's local gangs, which have proliferated as the economy has stalled out here, too.
So that is the context for this election, which is a runoff. The winner will be president for the next 4 years. Tell us about the two candidates.
Right. The race is a repeat of the 2023 snap elections, and the current president, who won those, has been in power for only 16 months. He's 37-year-old Daniel Noboa. He's the son of the richest man here in Ecuador. The family business is bananas, one of Ecuador's largest exports. Noboa is a close ally of President Trump, and he's pro-business, he's pro-free trade. His opponent, again, is a leftist former lawmaker and lawyer, Luisa Gonzalez. She's 47 and is a very close ally of the former firebrand leftist president, Rafael Correa, who ruled Ecuador for 10 years. He's in self-imposed exile after being convicted of corruption, but he still has a lot of sway and a loyal base here.
And is it fair to say that the crime and violence are the big issue for voters given all of this?
Yes, it is the issue. It seems as if everyone has been hit by the crime wave here. But you also hear a lot about former President Correa still, too. He's been out of power for nearly 10 years, so it's kind of crazy to hear so much about him. But there is a lot of polarization. His supporters look fondly on his rule. They tend to gloss over his corruption charges. His detractors blame him for much of the current economic and security crisis now. And like Correa, they say Gonzalez will bring socialism to Ecuador. Both candidates, though, say they will keep relying on the military for fighting the drug gangs. President Noboa has declared a state of emergency and declared he is fighting an internal war against terrorists. He's asked Trump personally for U.S. military assistance and even to put a base here. Mm. Gonzalez says that's a violation of Ecuadorian sovereignty, and she says she'll put more money into social programs and in hard-hit communities.
All of this settled in the election tomorrow. That is NPR's Carrie Kahn in Ecuador. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Trump administration is exempting some electronics from his new 145% tariffs on China, including smartphones and computers. It's a move that could help keep the price down on the electronics that aren't usually made in the U.S. China's new 125% tariffs on U.S. goods took effect today. The CDC says it can't help Milwaukee health officials who are trying to clean up lead contamination in several schools. Seven were closed temporarily this year because of lead levels up to 32 times higher than EPA standards, thanks to chipped lead paint. The CDC says it can't help because of the complete loss of its lead program after 2,400 jobs were recently cut. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners color choice shrubs offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. On Wednesday in the Oval Office, as markets reeled and a trade war raged, President Donald Trump signed an executive order that had nothing to do with tariffs.
There were some very bad things that happened with these law firms.
The law firm in question was Sussman Godfrey, but it was only the latest of many to be singled out and targeted by the president.
But they don't admit guilt. Remember that. They don't admit guilt.
The law firms had been guilty of, well...
In the president's telling, these are firms that have basically done things that are against American interests, that harm the United States.
That is Ryan Lucas, NPR's justice correspondent.
If you talk to people on the other side, the goal, however, is quite different. The law firms that are targeted say that the effort here is to intimidate them, to punish them for the clients that they have represented.
One of the clients that Sussman Godfrey represented, for example, was Dominion Voting Systems, which got a massive settlement from Fox News for its lies about the 2020 election. Other firms had represented Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, or had staff that worked on Robert Mueller's investigation into alleged ties between Trump's orbit and Russia and possible obstruction of justice during Trump's first administration. Now, this work has put them in the crosshairs of the president. Some have fought back. Sussman Godfrey, for instance, has filed a lawsuit to try and block the order. But others have cut deals. On Friday, Trump announced that five more law firms had reached deals with the administration in order to avoid damaging executive orders. They had agreed to provide hundreds of millions of dollars in pro bono work for causes that Trump supports. So today, for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we are going to dive into this dizzying legal drama with Ryan. I started our conversation by asking about the kinds of ramifications that these executive orders have on the firms being targeted.
What these executive orders do is a couple things. They differ a little bit from executive order to executive order, but the main ones that we've seen: suspend all security clearances for employees at the firms, bar the firm's employees from access to government buildings, government officials, end government contracts with the firms if there are any, and also reassess and ultimately terminate contracts that the firm's clients have with the government.
So when firms talk about this having crippling effects on them, they're not wrong. These are serious limitations for a big law firm that's doing a lot of government-related work.
The firms that have sued over these executive orders have said that if these executive orders are allowed to stay in place, they're essentially a death knell for their firms. If you're a law firm and you can't meet with government attorneys, or you can't even go into a government building, how are you supposed to appropriately and zealously advocate on your client's behalf? If you have a criminal client and you want to meet with prosecutors in order to discuss a potential plea deal, you can't do that.
You can't go into the federal building.
Can't go into a federal building. You can't meet with DOJ officials. If you represent a corporate client who wants to have a merger, if you want to go talk to government attorneys about this, you can't do that. And so how can you actively and effectively advocate on your client's behalf if you can't do sort of this basic legwork of the legal profession? And so that means that other clients aren't necessarily going to come to you for business. And it also means that some of the clients that you have may go somewhere else.
As you talk to people in the legal community, is there any precedent
for what President Trump is trying to do here is, what are people comparing this to? How are people framing this when you talk to them?
Well, when the first executive order targeting a law firm came down, that was in late February, and it was against the firm of Covington & Burling. And it was a pretty narrow executive order. But then we got these other executive orders that were far more sweeping. And I talked to a couple of constitutional law professors at the time, and everyone who I spoke to said, this is unprecedented. We've never seen something like this come out of the Oval Office. We've never seen a president take these sort of actions. And everyone who I've spoken to said that this really does chisel away at the very foundations of how the American legal system is supposed to work.
We haven't even gotten to one of the big storylines in what's going on here, and that's the different ways these big law firms have responded. You talked about several that have filed lawsuits trying to block this that are fighting back. A big storyline here is that several big law firms haven't fought back. They've cut deals with the Trump administration. What agreements are being reached, and how are people in those law firms responding when you talk to them?
Well, actually, there are nine firms at this point, including five just on Friday, that have cut deals with the president to try to either get out from being targeted by an executive order or to avoid the possibility of a punitive executive order. The first firm actually to cut a deal was Paul Weiss, a big New York-based firm, very prestigious, largely linked to Democrats. There are a number of former Biden administration and Obama administration officials who work at the firm. And the deal that they cut, the first one, was to provide $40 million worth of pro bono legal services to causes that both the firm and the White House support. And there was a lot of outrage and pushback when Paul Weiss cut this deal. Disappointment that a firm this prestigious and with deep pockets like Paul Weiss had decided not to stand up for the legal profession in the views of many people, and instead to cut a deal with the administration. Now, eight other firms have since followed suit, including five, as I mentioned, just on Friday. But what this all has done, what the president's targeting of law firms has done, is really kind of expose a divide within big law. I remember having conversations with partners in certain law firms where there's a question of whether the legal profession would be able to provide a sort of united front to push back against what universally everyone who I've spoken to has viewed as an assault on the legal profession,
yeah,
an assault on lawyers.
Because lawyers are being punished for doing lawyerly things.
For doing their job.
Yes.
For representing their clients zealously, which is what this whole system is based on.
You've been in NPR, what, 7 or 8 years at this point?
Yeah.
And over the time that I've known you and worked with you, you have covered a wide range of pretty high wire and pretty tense and at times unprecedented legal stories. You have covered the Mueller investigation. You have covered the House Republican attack on the Mueller investigation. You have covered the aftermath of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. You have covered the sitting president's son, Hunter Biden, being put on federal trial. All of these different stories that really...
Don't forget the special counsel investigations into Trump himself.
Those two.
Yes.
How does this fit into all of those other big stories? How does this feel different?
What I would say to that is this is not in a vacuum on its own,
yeah,
either. This is part and parcel of the sort of attacks that we're seeing on federal judges, threats against them online, calls from the president and members of his administration to impeach them for rulings that they don't like. I think what sets this apart from some of that other stuff is this is directed from the Oval Office. This is the power of the presidency being used against private actors, essentially accusing them and then judging them guilty of certain things, then using the power of the presidency to punish them.
You had a past life where you were a foreign correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about or seen any parallels between the type of stories you covered then and what you're covering right now?
So half of my career thus far was as a foreign correspondent in Poland, in Egypt, in Lebanon. It's a very different way of reporting. It's a very different style of reporting. You are focused more on kind of macro level things and trying to explain, mm-hmm, what's going on half a world away to an audience in the U.S. Covering the Justice Department, covering stuff in Washington generally, is at a much more micro level. It's a different kind of reporting. It takes a different kind of muscle to do.
Yeah. Does that make it harder in a moment like now where there's potentially a big shift happening? Does that make it harder to kind of realize the big shift is happening when you're not doing the big sweepy step back and you're doing the moment by moment updates?
I think from a bandwidth level, it's harder. Yes.
Yeah.
Because just the pace of the news right now is so intense that it can be very hard to get the daily stuff done and be able to provide the kind of big picture view for people. But I think what's similar in these two, not necessarily in the storylines or in trying to explain stuff, what is similar, though, I think, is I kind of view my job now as translating a foreign land for people, because the justice system is very different. Doesn't function how a lot of people think it does. A lot of times people will come to me with questions like, oh, can they do this? Oh, why did this happen? And often it's just like it's kind of an arcane judicial procedure. And so explaining sometimes to people, trying to translate what's going on in this weird judicial system with lawyerly language and trying to translate that into the way that normal people speak and what makes sense to them, I think is a big part of my job.
I remember a moment where you were doing that live on the radio. I was part of that coverage as well when the Mueller report was released and we were parsing
this long
legal document live and trying to do that translation in real time. Sometimes we succeeded, sometimes we didn't.
Still have nightmares of that day.
Well, hopefully we don't do that again anytime soon. That is NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Last December in Syria, people spilled out onto the streets to celebrate when their dictator fled. But in some cities, those joyful post-war scenes have given way to more dangerous streets and a crime wave. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from Aleppo, Syria's commercial capital, which was once a center for the gold trade in the ancient world.
This is the ancient gold market of Aleppo. There's a mangled metal, looks like maybe part of a burned car. There's 1, 2, 3 stone arches still intact, but you can see the sky now through the covered market. It burned my heart to see that ancient market bombed at the start of the war, says jeweler Mohammed Bunni. He jangles gold bracelets as he recalls salvaging some of them from the rubble and shifting to a modern shop across town. But he says he's traded one threat for another. The extortion and repression of the Assad regime is gone, but there's been a spike in violent robbery and theft, he says. A gold vendor near here was killed recently for his merchandise. Bunni has installed security cameras and now takes everything out of his shop windows at night. There's a lot more young men buzzing around on motorbikes, says Sarah Tijan, an art student I met near Aleppo University. She says she gets catcalled more. The same and worse happened after Egypt's dictator fell in 2011. Tijan says her neighbors have had their homes and cars broken into. Mohammed Beige drives a service, a shared taxi. And he says people are actually going out less, at least at night, now that the war is over. And so this is hurting his business. When Assad fell, the prisons flung open. The majority of those freed were political prisoners, he says. But some thieves got out, too. It was also a mistake, he says, for Syria's new government to disband the police and security forces when Assad fell. That happened in Iraq, too, in 2003, with disastrous results. Some of the unemployed became insurgents. At least the old police knew all the regular criminals, Beige says. Syria's new government is training up new recruits. There are police academy graduations practically every week. When NPR asked Syria's Interior Ministry for crime statistics, a spokesperson said they actually don't exist, but that crime has, quote, noticeably decreased since Assad's fall. Now, I guess it depends on whether you're talking about political crime or petty crime. But nearly everyone we've met has a story of either being robbed recently themselves or having it happen to someone they know. In a smoky back room of a restaurant late at night, Aleppo's business leaders are discussing how to shine light, literally, on crime.
We are trying to install lights all over Aleppo.
Unfortunately, half of the city is destroyed.
Basil Hamouia returned home from Dubai to help rebuild this city of more than 2 million, which has prided itself on entrepreneurial spirit since antiquity. With streetlights across Aleppo either destroyed or stolen, Hamouia and other business leaders are pooling their money to install solar-powered ones. 1,000 of them have been installed or repaired in their first week at this. He shows me a video of installations earlier the same day.
This is the civil defense, and they are working for free, by the way. We ask them, we need this kind of, I don't know how you call this truck.
Cherry picker.
Cherry picker, yes.
Hamouia says where there is war, there is poverty. And where there's poverty, there's crime. The war part of that is over, and now he's part of an effort to fix the rest. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Aleppo, Syria.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Today, the U.S. and Iran launched a new effort to negotiate a deal to scale back Iran's nuclear program. In his first term, President Trump pulled the U.S. out of an existing nuclear agreement with Iran and now believes he can negotiate a better one. For more, we are joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Scott.
So what do we know about this initial round of talks today?
So the two sides held talks for more than 2 hours in Oman's capital, Muscat, and the discussions were mediated by Oman. Now, this was just a get acquainted session. The sides are laying out some basics, a framework for the talks, and we know the key issues here. What will the limits be on Iran's nuclear program, and to what extent will Iran get relief from the tough sanctions imposed by the U.S.? But the mere fact that they met is certainly something unusual, and the White House called the talks, quote, positive and constructive. Iran struck a similar tone, and they agreed to meet again in a week.
Let's try to sort out one possible gap between the sides. Iran called these indirect talks. The Trump administration called them direct talks. Which one is it?
Well, Scott, both, it okay. seems. The two sides were physically apart at this Oman government compound, and Oman's foreign minister shuttled between them, so indirect talks. But at the end of the session, the leaders of the two delegations met and spoke briefly. We're talking about Steve Witkoff, Trump's Middle East envoy, and Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi. So it was also direct negotiations, or at least something both sides can live with.
Let's rewind a decade, Greg. The U.S. and Iran reached this nuclear agreement in 2015 under President Obama. Trump comes into office the first time around, says it was a bad deal, pulls out in 2018. How would this deal be different?
Yeah, that's the key question. Since Trump was so dismissive of that earlier agreement, he'll want one that he can present as much better. But the world has changed. Iran has now enriched uranium to a much higher level, about 60% purity, not quite the level needed for a nuclear weapon, which is around 90% purity, but close to it, something they could get to pretty quickly. The U.S. will have to win concessions just to get back to the point where we were in 2018 when Trump unilaterally withdrew. Meanwhile, Iran is vulnerable right now. Its economy is very weak. Its military suffered setbacks last year in missile exchanges with Israel. So it could be more willing to make compromises. Iran says it wants to keep the talks narrowly focused on the nuclear program. Trump and his team have spoken of broader goals, for example, ending Iran's support of proxy groups in the region.
Mm-hmm. How do these negotiations with Iran fit with Trump's broader goals in the Middle East right now?
So Trump has been very clear that he wants to avoid endless conflict in the Middle East. And a nuclear deal with Iran would certainly meet that goal, should certainly ease the tensions. But at the same time, Trump has been ramping up U.S. military involvement in the Middle East. Today, in fact, marks 4 weeks since the U.S. began a daily bombing campaign against the Houthis in Yemen, a group that Iran supports. And the presence of an American aircraft carrier in the Red Sea off Yemen and a powerful B-2 bombers on an island in the Indian Ocean, not that far away, is also seen as a warning to nearby Iran. Most analysts believe Trump is unlikely to resort to force at this stage. They point to these nuclear discussions, but the president keeps warning that if negotiations don't succeed, military force remains an option.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
This is NPR News.
The bond market is very tricky. I was watching it.
Amid all the week's turmoil on Wall Street, the yields on U.S. Treasury bonds stood out.
Yeah, I saw last night where people were getting a little queasy.
What the bond market tells us and why you should be listening, that and all the latest news, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Trump administration is ending temporary protected status for thousands of Afghans in the U.S., saying conditions in Afghanistan no longer meet the requirements. TPS for Afghanistan was established in 2022 after the U.S.'s disastrous withdrawal from the country that led to the Taliban's takeover. A federal judge has declined to block the Trump administration from immigration enforcement actions at houses of worship. A number of them sued, saying fear of raids was hurting their ability to worship. And delegations from the U.S. and Iran had indirect talks in Oman today in a new round of negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. They'll meet again next week. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Trump administration officials stunned local health departments across the country when they announced in March that they wanted to take back $11 billion in public health grants. Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News reports.
Local health departments have relied on the money from the Department of Health and Human Services for years. The grants began during the pandemic, but could be used for other health issues, such as mental illness, addiction, and infectious diseases.
We're going to cancel 18 vaccine clinics.
That's Teresa Cullen. She's director of Arizona's Pima County Health Department. The department lost $1 million in the clawbacks. HHS spokesperson Bianca Rodriguez Feliciano said the department wants the money back because the COVID pandemic is over. A judge has temporarily blocked the cuts in some states, including Arizona, after a group of state attorneys general sued. But Cullen says Arizona state officials told her to stop the work the money was paying for.
We've eliminated 2.5 months of the provision of care.
Other states, including Texas, Minnesota, and Washington, also canceled vaccine clinics they had on the calendar. In Washoe County, Nevada, the surprise cuts mean two contract staffers will be let go. Their job is setting up and marketing vaccination events, including for state-mandated back-to-school shots for illnesses such as measles. Lisa Lautritz is director of clinical health services for the area. She's canceling community vaccine drives that were scheduled to start this summer.
Without that team, I won't be able to do it because our core team can't be in two places at once.
That core team of nurses doesn't have time to run the local clinic and do the setup for community events. That means they will no longer be out and about offering shots at churches and senior centers. Instead, she says, patients will have to make an effort to come to them.
someone that doesn't have insurance or doesn't have access to health care, they're going to be the ones that suffer from the cuts.
This isn't the first time in her 30-year career that Lautritz has dealt with the loss of funding, but she says her community is sicker now because of budget cuts over a decade ago. For example, a local grant that paid for home visits to pregnant women was eliminated. More babies in the county are being born with syphilis, which Lautritz says could be prevented if that program was still around.
That was reporter Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News. The Pitt, which wrapped its first season on Max this week, has been lauded for being one of the only medical shows to, quote, get it right. The it is the nitty-gritty of medicine itself and what it's like to work in a big city emergency room. There is another thing The Pitt is getting praised for getting right, though, and that is the portrayal of a neurodivergent character, second-year resident Dr. Mel King.
As you can see, we have some new faces with us this morning. Good morning, good morning. Come on over. Starting with second-year resident Dr. Melissa King, fresh from the VA.
Everyone calls me Mel. I'm so happy to be here.
Mel is portrayed by actress Taylor Dearden, who joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, you've seen this in all of the reviews of the show, and I have seen this in conversation with multiple doctors I know, including doctors who work in ERs. They've said this show kind of, obviously it's a show and it's dramatized a little bit, but it gets it in an accurate way more than any other show. What is it about the approach that you all took that you think nailed it so well?
Well, we had 2 weeks of medical boot camp before we started shooting, which was incredibly helpful. And all trauma scenes are directed by doctors instead of the director. It serves the medicine is the whole goal. And I remember at the very beginning, John Wells told us that if we are unsure about something, instead of going to the director, if it's medical, just always listen to the doctor, even if the director wants something else, like always listen to the doctors.
And the directors were okay with that?
They don't know that happened.
Yes. You know, Mel is, we heard that early on clip. This is a room filled with burned out, cynical, frustrated people. And that is not her. She is not a cynical person. She is a joyous person. She's a positive person. What do you think it is that she finds so rewarding about an incredibly hard job?
I think that it's incredibly hard and that Mel can do it. Recognizing that something's hard for anyone and then being able to overcome it if you are neurodivergent, like, hopefully that should just make it even sweeter.
Can we talk about the thing I mentioned in the introduction, and you mentioned it as well? You know, Mel is often at times a little awkward in a very charming way, and likable way, and it seems like sarcasm is a tricky dynamic for her to pick up among other things, and she's been talked about in reviews and online chatter as being described as having autistic coded behaviors, which my understanding is she's not, but I've heard you say in interviews that she has ADHD. What should we know, and what do you think about?
I don't know what Mel's diagnosis is. I have ADHD.
Yeah.
So I think I've just been letting some of the things that I am better at masking, I'm just letting the mask come down a little bit more. I have a few friends whose siblings are more need autism, and because of that, they never noticed that their younger child, my friends, are also autistic. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, trying to show that it really is a spectrum, and also that, you know, ADHD has finally been put on the same spectrum as autism.
I think a lot of people have somebody in their family or somebody in their life who does have ADHD and see all the different ways it could play out. It was interesting you said that there's behavior that you sometimes mask that you don't mask in the scenes. Can you give us one example maybe from one scene where you kind of consciously thought about that or just played out that way on camera?
I think a lot of my anxiety I'm able to mask better. And I just kind of liked the idea that Mel can't mask much of anything, mm-hmm. especially because of how sweet she is. It's just, you know, you get all Mel all the time.
You okay?
I am. I get frustrated when I can't do things, or at least it looks like it.
Yeah, you and me both.
Thanks, but my frustration manifests itself emotionally, and then I get upset, and then it looks like I can't handle things, and, you know, then I can't cry in front of the patient because no one wants to see their doctor cry. That's just a big red flag.
You just hit a perfect crack. You're doing great.
I think There've been a few scenes of just like recovery too. There's a scene where Mel is looking at a lava lamp app. We're listening to the ocean sound. Mm-hmm. And it's all of the self-soothing and stimming that is, which I'm really glad they show that part, because they don't usually show that.
Is there anything that you personally in real life learned from this experience, whether it was that medical boot camp or the front end or way the show was approached or filmed?
This is it's a very tough show for neurodivergents to be in.
Yeah.
It moves really fast. It's really hard words. It's actions we just learned. You have to put all of that together at the same time and as quickly as possible. And we go so quickly, we don't have much time to take a second to review, to calm down. Mm-hmm. And so it's definitely a challenge to shoot.
Can I ask, you're talking about the importance of showing that recovery time for Mel, the character. Is that something you were trying to make sure to get for yourself as an actor on set in this environment that seemed just as overwhelming as it really are?
Yeah, and it's tough to find the time. It's also very tough to explain to people what's going on inside. If it's not, you can't see that I'm panic-stricken. It's kind of hard to understand that I am. I eventually had to get some earplugs that just soften external noise so that you could at least try and hear better of just what's in front of you. And I started wearing those, which I definitely pitched like, yeah, I think Mel should wear these, which is just so that I can wear them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that have to happen for it to be, I don't know, comfortable to explore.
You're talking about your experience on the set, portraying a neurodivergent character as somebody who's neurodivergent yourself. And you're talking about kind of the challenges that creates. But it seems like you've also made a decision to be okay and open talking about it to the press, talking about it in public in a way that I think a lot of people would shy away from doing. Was that an active decision on your end? Why do you think that's important to be honest about?
It was. When I talked to Scott and John early on in the med boot camp that we had, I told them that I relate to this character because I see a lot of the neurodivergent parts of Mel as something I experience all the time. And John said something that was just like, I didn't even think about it. And he was just so wonderful. He said, do you want to come out of the neurotypical neurodivergence closet, so to speak, for the show? Are you willing to do that? And I had never thought of, oh yeah, that is something you have to think of. And I took it home, I thought it over, and I realized it's like, you know, I can mask only so much, and I'm really ready for people to know. I tell everyone I meet, because there are certain social behaviors that might seem odd, and so I usually have to tell everyone I meet, like, in case I do this, just so you know, it's not on purpose. So it was great for them to let it be my decision completely. I feel like it's the right move.
That is actress Taylor Dearden. She plays Dr. Mel King on Max's The Pitt. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
We are getting close to the end of this evening's show, but we are going to beat on Boats Against the Current, Borne Back Ceaselessly into the Past. And if you heard that and had a visceral flashback to sophomore year English, you are not alone. The Great Gatsby turned 100 this past week, and for much of that time, the novel, about a man struggling to reinvent himself, even with his new wealth, has been taught in high schools across the country. So we have brought in two English teachers to talk about it. Alexandra Howes works at Twin Cities Academy in St. Paul, Minnesota, which happens to be author F. Scott Fitzgerald's birthplace. And Alonzo Vereen is at Sidwell Friends School in D.C. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And Alonzo, let me start with you. What was your relationship with this book? Did you appreciate it from the beginning? Did it take a few times? Did it have to grow on you?
You know, initially, it was quite an antagonistic relationship. I mean, I am a Black man from the American South. Let's start there. And I first read Gatsby as a 20, 21-year-old college student. And I really struggled with it. It wasn't just the language and the structure, but the very ideas in Gatsby, and the characters who populate Gatsby or don't populate Gatsby. You know, Gatsby is set in the 20s, right, in New York City, but there are only three Black characters in the novel, and they're minor characters. The language around them is kind of crass, two bucks and a girl, the yolks of their eyeballs rolling around their heads. So it took a while for me to find a way to see myself in the novel and to see why it was so lauded.
Alexandra, what about you? Have you thought about this book, and how has that changed, if at all, over the years?
Certainly, I guess for me, it was love at first read. So I guess for me, it's always been one of my favorite things to teach because of the obvious local connection. It's very neat to be able to say this author literally grew up blocks away from you and struggled with some things as well. And the ways I go about teaching it, I do a little fake speakeasy with ginger ale and Sprite.
When you do your speakeasy with ginger ale, do students recreate the meme from the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yes.
And Alonzo, you alluded to this a little bit earlier, but I would love you to spell out the way that you've kind of taken an outside-the-box approach to race and this text, specifically Jay Gatsby's race.
Yeah, when I was trying to access the novel myself, I stumbled upon Carlisle Van Thompson's interpretation that Gatsby is a Black man passing. And I was drawn to that interpretation because it's a provocative idea. And I must say that whenever I present this idea to my students, they say, you know, Mr. Vereen, that's a stretch. But when I asked them to do the work of finding textual evidence to prove whatever interpretation they've already landed on, they began to become a bit less skeptical. Gatsby is unraced. His race and ethnicity are both ambiguous. And so as a result, he can be, in a way, any American. We can all layer our identities on top of Gatsby and find a way for us to exist within one of America's greatest novels. And that seems to get them to buy in to the text.
And a lot of students, I feel, depending on where they come from, can connect to Gatsby's story. He has hopes and dreams, which teenagers are in that space. I think that's what's so powerful about the book, is students being able to identify with these characters, and that a lot of it has to do with Gatsby himself.
Both of you are well aware that we are living in a moment of backlash to that type of educational approach, to just about any sort of different approach when it comes to race in a classic text, right? So what to you is the value and importance of making a text connect with the students in this kind of way?
Well, fiction is not anthropology. And so one thing that I try to do with teaching Gatsby is to just let the students know that we co-create this text. You can say that Gatsby's Black. You can say that Nick's gay. You just have to identify the evidence that backs up your point. And allowing students the opportunity and the space to stretch their imaginations as far as they possibly can, I think is one of the responsibilities we have.
Yeah, I'd agree with a lot of that. Because I believe my job isn't to tell my students what to think. It's to give them a space to explore ideas and not to necessarily shut them down as right or wrong, but rather, why do I think this? I want them thinking critically. I think it just makes them better people that they're thinking about the things they're coming across in their lives.
I feel like I was back in high school English in the best possible way with this conversation. It's always my favorite class. That was Alexandra Howes and Alonzo Vereen. Thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about The Great Gatsby.
Thank you.
Of course, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
That is All Things Considered for this Saturday. I'm Scott Detrow. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again tomorrow.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.